I want us to consider a story in the New Testament that you're probably well aware of, but it's a very strange story. In fact, it's only told once in the Gospel of Mark. And that's a little unusual because most of the Gospel of Mark's stories are also told in Matthew and Luke. There's only about four that are uniquely told in Mark. So 95-96% of Mark is already in Matthew and Luke as well. They tell the story slightly differently to make points to their different audiences. But on this occasion, Matthew and Luke, even though this particular story is available to them, choose not to include it in their Gospels. And you might wonder why. What's wrong with it? Well, it is a bit strange. And in fact, it raises more questions initially than it does answers. And that's useful because I actually want to talk about questions and those times when we have questions and the answers aren't forthcoming. It's a story about a man who gets healed. And he lives in a little town called Bethsaida. And he's not the only one who is sick. In fact, in the first century, most people were ill. And many of them would have been seriously ill from time to time. The average age would be about 35. That's when you started getting ready to die. It's very different living in the first century. Many people never even got that far. They died in childbirth. And it was an era that was brutish and hard, and life was difficult. So this man wasn't the only one who was ill, but he's the only one who's healed. And you can imagine that the others in the town are wondering, well, why him? Why not me? Why not us? And it wasn't due to anything that was wrong in their own lives. It wasn't that Jesus had run out of compassion or power. But the answers aren't given to those questions. And there's times in your life, in my life, in the past, in the recent past, who knows what's going to happen in the near future, when we will have received an email or a letter in the mail, and as a result of that, hope has fled out the window. We've received a conversation on the telephone, or our children have spoken to us, or our siblings, or our parents, or our boss, and as a result of that, the cold and icy blast of fear has come into the room and gripped us, and our stomachs have churned, and our lips have grown dry, and our hearts have begun to beat faster, and questions have come into our minds that we had not anticipated ever asking. And one of the most dangerous questions that comes to us is, where's God? And does God know? And even, is there a God? And tumbling after this fear is doubt. And very quickly associated with doubt is a sense of guilt. Should I be feeling afraid? Should I be feeling uncertain? Should I be scared? Is it appropriate for a Christian to have these questions? And the people to whom Mark will tell his particular story are exactly the same, but their situation of fear is much greater than that which most of us will ever experience, thank God. Because they're living in Rome, and they are amongst the majority poor. They've already been marginalized because they have chosen to follow Jesus, this strange, idiotic gospel of a man who has apparently come to this earth and lived and died as a criminal on a cross, and then nonsensically you've even begun to believe that he's risen from the dead. How foolish you people are. You're marginalized because you're very poor. You're marginalized because you have put your faith in what appears to be a nonsense gospel. And on top of that, you are now going to experience persecution, the likes of which Christians have never experienced before. But they will later. Because the time in which Mark writes his gospel is a time when the emperor on the Roman throne is Nero. And there is a great fire that has taken place in Rome in the middle AD 60s. And as a result of that fire, about two-fifths of the city has burned down and countless hundreds of people have lost their lives. And it's suspected that the one who has caused this fire is none other than Nero, this tyrannical emperor whose life is immoral to the extreme. And people turn to him and point the finger accusationally to him. And he, recognizing that the force of the majority population is moving in his direction, puts the finger of blame somewhere else. You probably guess where it's going. It's going to the Christians, this small group of majority, poor, minority, ridiculed people. And he blames the Christians. And although the people in Rome don't believe the rumor, who are they to stand up against the emperor? Tacitus, a Roman historian, makes this point that the people of Rome didn't believe that the Christians were to blame, but Nero was the emperor. And that resulted in Christians being crucified by Nero's soldiers for this apparent crime of burning the city of Rome. He did it probably because he wanted to build Rome in his own image, and to do that he had to get rid of the old Rome, but it went out of control. Those Christians who were crucified and others who weren't crucified were burned alive on the way to Nero's palace. They were roasted alive in bronze caskets. And questions came to the minds of the Christians. Why are we going through this? What have we done wrong? How have we sinned? Where's God? Does he know? And the answers don't come. And fear begins to haunt their steps, because they don't know where they're going to be tomorrow, and they don't know if their children are going to be with them tonight, and they don't know whether they can plan for next week. In fact, they can't. And Mark has to give a message of hope to these people, and he does it by telling them a story. And it's a story that is describing a man who is also unable to see. Not the future, he just can't see the present because he's blind. And they're blind. They are living in a mist of uncertainty and confusion because they can't see. But this particular man is touched by Jesus and he is healed, but not completely. And then eventually he is healed. What's the message of the story? Well, I'll read it to you first. And if you have your Bibles, you can read it with me. It's in the Gospel of Mark. And it's in chapter 8. I've had to borrow Pastor Robin's Bible because I forgot my own. Not a good start. But I took it not as a sign that I shouldn't preach, that I should borrow somebody else's Bible. This is it, Mark chapter 8. I'm reading from verse 22. Jesus came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him, and they begged him, "Please touch him." So Jesus chose not to touch him, but instead took that blind man and led him by the hand out of the town. And when he had, maybe this is why the story isn't preached on very often, when Jesus had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, he asked if he saw anything. And the man looked up and said, "Well, I do see men, but they're like trees, walking trees." And then he put his hands on his eyes again, and he made him look up. And this time he was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Strange story. Spitting in people's eyes, taking two goes to get somebody healed, not healing them straight away, but taking them away from the crowd. Why are you doing this, Jesus? I think there are two things that I would want to suggest that Mark is trying to present to his readers that are appropriate for us as well. Number one, Jesus is in charge of all of us, whatever our situation is. And number two, he is in control of our journey, be it in darkness, be it in misty perceptions, or be it when we can see clearly. So I just want to unpack this story. We'll ask questions of the text, and hopefully we'll get some answers of the text. Here's this man, he's blind. And that's exactly what the Roman readers are. They are blind. They cannot see ahead, and they cannot even see if Jesus is with them. And although some of us seem to live lives that are charmed and nothing much bad happens to us, most of us from time to time find ourselves also in situations of darkness and confusion and fear. We didn't anticipate this. We thought when we became Christians, everything would be hunky-dory and lovely, and it's a bit of a shock to us to find that we can be emotionally, psychologically, physically, not as we thought we would be when we signed up to follow Jesus. And we begin to doubt. And then we begin to wonder, is it wrong to doubt? Should I not be asking questions? And I want to encourage you not to be so worried about God's feelings about your asking questions of him. He's a lot more capable of accommodating our doubts, our fears, our questions. Good grief. He made us as we are. He knows our fragility, our vulnerability, our inadequacies, our weaknesses. He knows that. And he still says, come on, I want you to be part of my journey. And let's remember also that this is not our life that we have been destined for. This is just a little envelope of time, but we've been destined for eternity. That's where our home is, not here. So here Jesus is being presented with this blind man, and they beg him, please touch him, Jesus. And instead, he takes the man away from the crowd. And I'm thinking, why? On other occasions, you have just dealt with the problem immediately, spontaneously. There hasn't been any time lapse. You've just done it and done it and done it and done it very quickly. Why are you taking this man away from the crowd, Jesus? There's no evidence that there was a problem in the crowd, that somehow they lacked the faith and they were a problem to Jesus. That would be possibly the case anyway, but this crowd brought the man to Jesus. So why is Jesus taking the man away? Well, maybe it's because Jesus wants to spend a little time with the man. Maybe Jesus is testing the man's faith. Here he is, he's blind, he can't see. He has to take Jesus' hand and follow where Jesus leads him, and he doesn't know where Jesus is leading him, and he has to trust him. And that's not going to be easy for this man, because there's no evidence that this man has ever seen Jesus or known about Jesus before, and he certainly hasn't seen him. So he trusts Jesus, and this is a story of trust to people like you and me and people who are in Rome who need not to be able to get out of that situation, because they won't. They will be killed as followers of Jesus, but they need to know that Jesus is with them in that situation. I wondered if Jesus came down this hall this morning and you watched him walking down, and if he was to walk down, I think I'd probably be moving the microphone away from my mouth and passing it to Jesus, because I would have anticipated that he would want to have spoken to you. But imagine if instead he does what I'm doing and he looks at you and then he walks back as if he's done all he wants to do and he's not going to be preaching, but instead as he's walking around he looks and then he sees, and excuse me just walking amongst you and disturbing you, but it's one way of keeping you awake, and I just touch this lady. Would you mind giving me your name? Mevonin. What a great name. Mevonin. I may say that wrong again. Imagine if he'd done that and he just tapped Mevonin's shoulder and said, come on, I'd like to take you away from the crowd. Nobody else, just you. He's walked past these five young ladies here and he's gone to Mevonin. Now, and if I was one of them, I'd be feeling just a little bit miffed. What's so special about her that Jesus has touched her and said, come on, let's spend a little bit of time together. But of course, she would feel special, and rightly so, that Jesus had have chosen her. And she's probably a better Christian than me, but if it had been me, I would have taken my time to stand up slowly and let everybody know that Jesus had chosen me and not anybody else, and walked out ever so slowly with Jesus out there. The message that Mark, I think, is wanting to present to his readers and that Jesus is wanting to present to the crowds is that he has time for individuals, even individuals who can't see him, don't even know who he is, can't recognize his power and his ability. But Jesus says, I want to spend some time with you, special time with you. At this stage, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. There he's going to be crucified, and he's in effect saying, I've got time, my time, to spend with you. He didn't need to do this. He could have clicked his fingers, and this man would have been healed. But no, there's more of a message here. This is not a message that Jesus is a healer, or the best healer since this world has begun. This is a Jesus who has time, his time, to uniquely and personally and individually lead people through to the next part of their journeys. Lays his hands on the man. That's not so special for us when people were being prayed for. There's quite a few people laying hands on them. But in the first century, it's the one thing you wouldn't do. You don't lay hands on somebody who is physically ill, because the assumption by the Jewish people is that if you are physically ill, then you must have sinned. I'm wearing glasses. That must be because I've done something wrong and God has put his mark upon me. We don't believe that, and we are right not to believe that, but the Jewish people did. And the danger, therefore, of somebody touching somebody who is physically ill is that they also will be marked by the ceremonial uncleanness that God has put on that person. So the rabbis never touched anybody who was ill. You don't get Jewish doctors in the first century because they would be seen to be undermining what God has done in giving sickness in the first place. It's not true. It's what the people believe. But what does Jesus do? Jesus touches people. And you'll notice this when you look for it. He stretches to touch people. He stretches to touch the leper. He makes it quite clear that it's not an accidental brushing up alongside of a leper. No, he's gone out of his way to touch them. And it's his way of saying, that ceremonial uncleanness that you think has caused your leprosy, it's not going to contaminate me. And there's nothing about you that's going to stop my power of transformation coming into your life. So his touch is making a powerful message to somebody who feels that his blindness is probably because he must have sinned really badly. And Jesus is leading this person to the truth, the light of reality, that isn't the case. But then he does something, and I have to mention it because I wouldn't be authentic if I didn't. Jesus spits in his eyes. Now the other story, funnily enough, that Mark tells, and only Mark tells, also has Jesus spitting. This, on that occasion, he spits on his tongue. Would you give me your tongue? No, it's okay. But thank you for your willingness so to do. Because there's a man who's got a problem with his tongue, and Jesus does that, and then touches the man's tongue. How disgusting is that? How gross. Here it's even worse. He spits on somebody's eyes. I didn't see it happening this morning when people were at the front. Maybe they did. I saw one or two people jumping back. Maybe that's what was going on. I don't think so. Why does Jesus spit on this poor blind man's eyes? It's just so gross of Jesus. Well, it would be if we were living in the first century. But perhaps you're with me anyway, because when I was a little boy, I used to live in South Wales. You might have guessed that. And I lived in the country, and from time to time as a little boy, I would come home because I'd graze my knee, and I would be crying, and I would come to my mother, who didn't resort to medicines. Why should she? She had her own internal medicine in the form of spittle. And that spittle, when it was put on her tongue and on my scratch, a miracle occurred, and my tears stopped, and I was healed and transformed and ran off to play with my friends. And some of you have also benefited from your mother's spittle, and if you are mothers, maybe you have transferred that to your children, and they haven't suffered. Well, in the first century, that was part of the ancient worldview also. Spittle was associated with therapeutic powers. And bear this in mind with Pastor Robin, the spittle of rabbis, kind of equivalent to a 21st century pastor, thought the spittle of the rabbi had special powers. And if that rabbi had fasted for 40 days, then that spittle had even more significant power. Catch him when he's been fasting. Ask him for a little bit of spittle, it'll do you a power of good. This Jesus, the man hasn't seen him, but he must have got an awareness that this is a special man. And when he feels his spittle, just that gentle spray on his eyes, he knows something therapeutic is going to happen. Now, why are you doing this, Jesus? Just get on with it. Just heal him, for goodness sake. Why do you have to take him out of the village and waste time? Why do you have to touch him? Why do you have to spray spittle on him? Such a rigmarole. Just heal him. Yeah, but this isn't a message of healing. This is a message of Jesus taking time to be with somebody who is blind and can't see. And it's Jesus' way of saying, I want to deal with you individually. I want to lead you to your healing in a way that's appropriate to you and to your worldview. This is me giving you my special time. This is a much more significant Jesus than simply a new prophet on the block who has the capacity to heal like nobody else has done in the past. The readers in Rome need to know that Jesus has time for them, who can lead them through their journey. You and I need to know that Jesus has the capacity to understand what we're experiencing when nobody else does, as Robin mentioned a little earlier. Nobody else might know, but he does. And he has the ability to stay close with us and to walk with us until that season has come to a conclusion. But then there's just one other part in this story that I need to mention. And I think probably it's of real significance, because you'll know that Jesus touches him and he gets healed, but he can't see properly. And then Jesus has another go, and this time he gets healed and he can see completely. And I wonder whether you thought, oh, that's a bit of a shame. I thought Jesus was better than that, but hey, thankfully, Jesus had two goes to get him healed, so there's hope for us. Is that the message? Is that the message? Or maybe this was a tough case of blindness, and Jesus had one go and then had to get a bit more energy together to get it done properly. Is that the message? Jesus has healed blind people before. He's raised people from the dead before. No, that's not the message. This isn't the message that Jesus somehow has limited power. He has glorious power. So what is the message? The message is about not being able to see and about being able to see. And how do you cope in the time when you can't see? He's blind, he can't see. And then he is in a state of confusion because he can see, but it's very misty. And the people, well, I'm not too sure, is that a person or is it a tree? The only reason I can tell the difference is because I'm not aware the trees walk, but it's not clear. And then later, he's going to be completely healed. The message for Mark is that Jesus is in charge of the man when he's blind, of the man when he can't see properly, and of the man when he can see completely. Jesus is in charge of each moment, and in his time, he will take people from one to the next, from the next to the next, in his time. And that's going to be the case for the people in Rome. And this is part of a sermon that Mark will be presenting here. This is just the middle part of the sermon. And I've got to be careful not to forget the beginning and the end of the story. Because the story prior to this has the disciples with Jesus when Jesus fed thousands of people. And they're coming back on the lake. And Jesus says to them, watch out for the Pharisees, because they're like leaven. They'll just permeate your community if you're not careful. And they'll sow seeds of dissension. Watch them. And the disciples completely misunderstand. And Mark says that the disciples thought that Jesus was cross with them because they hadn't brought any bread with them. Come on, Jesus has just fed thousands of people with hardly any bread. But they're all concerned because they think Jesus is cross because they haven't brought any bread with them in the boat. And Jesus says, haven't you got any eyes that you can see? Do you understand who I am? And then he has this story which is about sight. And then immediately he follows it with Jesus saying to the disciples, who do you think I am? And they give their views. And then he says, yeah, but who do you think I am? And Peter says, I know. You're Jesus. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God. Excellent. Spot on, Peter. Well done. You've got it right. You can see who I am truly. Immediately, Jesus says, let me tell you what's going to happen to me. I'm going to be taken to Jerusalem and the religious leaders are going to arrest me, they're going to imprison me, they're going to beat me, they're going to kill me. The same guy who got it right says, Jesus, I'm so awfully sorry to tell you, but you've got it wrong. That can't possibly happen because I've just told you, you're the Messiah, the Son of God. You cannot possibly be crucified and killed. And Jesus says to Peter, who just got it right, get away from me, Peter, because you're speaking with the mouth of the devil. Got it right. And he got it wrong. And this is a story about getting it right, seeing clearly, getting it wrong, not seeing clearly. Here's this man, he is in the darkness of not being able to see at all. And then Jesus is with him and leads him to a position of confusion and certainty. Still can't see, still not too sure what the future is, and is still a bit worried about it. And then in his time, Jesus leads this man to the next stage, which is complete transformation. My message to you is the same message that Mark offered to his readers in Rome. And it is simply this, that yes, there are times when our lives are dominated by darkness. Not confusion, just complete darkness. We cannot see the future as a result of that phone call, or that conversation, or that email, or that knock on the door. Darkness has taken over all of the light. It's gone. And there are other times in our lives when we're in a mixture of darkness and light. We're not too sure whether darkness is going to be the next stage of our journey or whether it is going to be more light. And confusion and fear are still there, but not so great as it was when we were in complete darkness. And then there are other seasons in our lives when everything seems to be going fine. The point is that none of those seasons are due to us having walked away from God necessarily. They're not due to God's compassion on us somehow being watered down necessarily, well, completely. They are evidences of what life is sometimes like. And life sometimes is brutish and nasty and ambushes us. But the message of Mark to his readers is that Jesus can be trusted. Now, I know that can be sound so cliched and so simplistic and so easy to say when somebody is not in times of darkness and not in times of light and not in times of uncertainty in the middle, but it's nevertheless a truth. And whether you're in the darkness or in the mists of uncertainty now or in the light, take a hold of that truth and tuck it into your minds for those times when you are in darkness and you are in confusion, because it's certainly true. Just popped into my mind an occasion in my life when, with our two children, Luke and Anna Marie, Judy and I were on holiday. This is many years ago, and we were walking near a cliff in the south of England, and because I knew the danger of the cliff, I reached my hand down to our little boy, Luke, and because Luke was aware of the danger, he chose to take hold of my hand. It's a simple story, but it is representative of the truth that God has reached down into your life and taken your hand. He did that before you took his hand. And when you came to him in faith and asked for him to be part of your journey in this life and the next, he put his hand onto your life. And the more we realize that, the more we will find our grip on him tightening. And it's a funny thing, but when I reached my hand to Luke and Luke took it, not necessarily because he knew the severity of the danger, but I did, it was only when he recognized my hand that his hand on mine grew tighter. And the message to us here is that God puts his hand in our lives, holds us tightly because he is more committed to us than we are to him. And he's happy for that. But let me say that again. He is more committed to us and to our destiny than we are to him. And he is more determined for us to achieve what he would love us to achieve than what we would love to achieve for him. It sounds unfair, it sounds unbalanced, and it is. Because God's love for us is unilateral, it is completely unfair, undeserved, but that's who he is. So may I encourage you, where you are, to learn from the story of Mark. Don't see it simply as a sign of Jesus' healing, but a sign of Jesus giving time, his time, to lead us on our journey, wherever we happen to be, however we are happening to be feeling, however unique that emotion, that experience is, he is committed to take us to the next stage of the journey. And the next stage of the journey might not be complete light. It might be darkness. It might be confusion. And we may be in that confusion for months, years. The message is he's with us. He cannot possibly leave us because he's committed himself. Let me pray for you. Father, I sense that this is almost sacred ground as we're exploring your incredible love for us. None of us would put our hands up and say that we deserve even a nod from yourself in our direction. And yet you have chosen to invest yourself in us. You have chosen to encapsulate us with yourself, to envelop us with who you are. Would you help us? I don't even know whether it's right to pray this, but I think it is because we're pretty fragile, but would you help us to recognize the truth of that? Would you help us, Spirit, to recognize that our position as the sons and daughters of God is not presumptuous thinking on our part, but is truth? And on the basis of that, would you give us the confidence, the self-confidence, the spark of joy, peace, perspective of who we are in you. Amen.